Okay, good evening. I'm broadcasting live October 28th, 2015. Experiencing multiple technical difficulties. So, two nights ago is when we had the first echo problem. So now all of a sudden we've got an echo problem, which, means I'm going to have to start wearing headphones. And the last Dhammapada video looked kind of weird, so hopefully that's fixed now. And there was an audio problem as well, but I think that's fixed now. Better check the plugs though, just a second. We had a loose cable last time, caused problems. So we're going to do another Dhammapada now, verse 99. We'll start with that. I have to change the battery in just a second. Looks like we're good to go. What else can go wrong? Okay, ready. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse number 99, which reads as follows. Ramaniyani aranyani yatha naramati jano Vitaraga ramisanti natte kama gavesino. Which means, those forests are delightful where there is no person who delights. Vitaraga ramisanti, those free from passion will delight, not the kama gavesino, not those who are gone to or are seeking out gavesa, not those who seek out pleasure. So, quite an instructive verse. Again, quite similar to our last verse, if you're keeping up, the last one was about delightful forests as well, but that was about where an arahant dwells. Anywhere an arahant dwells, that's a delightful place. So this verse actually doesn't really have a place in the Arahatavagga, except that it follows after the last verse, which did talk about arahants. Of course, this one does talk about enlightened beings, and the story is about arahantship, so let's get right to the story. Here we have a story of a monk who was practicing meditation in the forest. He had found this delightful forest in which to meditate. He had thought to himself, oh, here's a place where I will certainly progress in my practice. And so he strove to his utmost in this forest, doing walking and sitting meditation. But fortune had it, or bad fortune it was, that a courtesan or a prostitute happened to think the same thing. Boy, this forest would be a nice place to meet a client. Good place. So two kinds of delighting, or two kinds of pleasure, two kinds of enjoying they had the same idea, but for two different types of enjoyment. So the monk was here sitting in the forest, and the prostitute or courtesan, or however you want to translate it, was also in the forest with an appointment with one of her clients. And so she was quite near where the monk was, and she was sitting in the forest, patiently waiting for her client, and as it turned out, her client didn't show up. So she was left sitting in this forest waiting for her client until finally, impatient, she realized he's certainly not going to show up. Might as well just go back home. And on her way back home, lo and behold, she spied a monk. I guess he was somewhat handsome or at least looked like a suitable client, and someone who might be gullible enough or might be beguiled by her ways. And so she decided in her mind, she made up her mind in a very, you could say, a fairly unwholesome decision to seduce the monk. And so she went up to this monk who was sitting there valiantly striving in meditation. He wasn't enlightened, so there was hope for her. And so she came up close to where the monk was and cleared her throat. And the monk looked up and saw her, and she let her robe slip a little bit and showed a little bit of, you know, just sitting as though she was just there to perhaps meditate or to enjoy the peace and quiet, but moving her skirts ever so slightly to show her legs and shifting around and, you know, showing off her attributes. And sure enough, the monk found his concentration begin to waver. He found himself suddenly rather disturbed, and not sure. It's an interesting thing that he says. It's as though he's never felt such desire before, because his whole body begins to shake, and you know, maybe his sweat comes out of his armpits, or his body heats up, and he becomes confused. He doesn't know what it is. He doesn't understand what's happening to him. So he actually says, "What is this?" King, something like King Nu Ko Idang or something. What is this? What the heck is going on? Anyway, he was quite disturbed, and probably in a bit of trouble. Who knows what would have happened if it weren't for our favorite savior, no? The one who would always save the monks, who saved the monks from themselves, the Buddha. The Buddha was watching out for him, and it's again one of these cases where you might believe or you might not believe. It might be unbelievable to some people. But the Buddha had this power in his mind, the ability to sense or a heightened awareness of reality. So the story goes that he knew what was going on. He was able to understand and furthermore able to communicate with this monk. If you don't like that, if that sounds far-fetched and implausible, well, that's fine. It's not a matter. It's more the meaning behind the story. But for most of us, there's a sense that there is more possible than most of us are able to understand. So these ideas of ESP or telepathy, clairvoyance, clairaudience, mind reading, even prediction of the future, these kind of things, there is some sense that to some extent the mind that is cultivated can engage in these things. And there's accounts by the ton of meditators who claim to have these powers. Now, they seem to be a bit unpredictable and certainly hard to capture by doctors looking to prove or disprove. So there's been experiments that have been done, and if you can learn about some of these experiments that they've done in textbooks, and often are inconclusive. I mean, it's a hard thing to test, because it takes an exceptional frame of mind, and exceptions are not something that science does best with, of course. You know, it's the easiest to prove or disprove something that is that applies to the majority, right? Because then you can get statistically meaningful results. But if you're dealing with a one in a million thing, no? It's something that most people can't do. It's a little bit harder. Of course, most people just deny this, the possibility outright, but then most people don't practice meditation and don't have a sense of the power of the mind. Anyway, either way, that's not the point of the story. The point is what the Buddha taught to this monk. So if you don't like the actual story, you can pretend it's a story about the Buddha being with this monk and he sees what's going on. Maybe he was meditating right beside the monk. That's not how the story goes, but you can look at it that way. It's the same meaning because the Buddha turns to the monk and says, Aramaniyani Aranyani. It says, you want to know what's going on? Why you're not happy? It says, you can only really enjoy the forest if you're not full of lust. There's more to this verse actually than the story tells, but this is when the Buddha is said to have told this verse. But there's a more, there's a deeper meaning here. Because being alone in the forest is tough. If you go off into the forest thinking, I'm going to be free from all my problems, you learn pretty quick that all your problems come with you. And if you're not able to overcome this desire, it doesn't matter whether you're in the forest or in the city. He makes the point here that the works has to be done. Now, going into the forest is great. It's a great opportunity to focus your mind on the essentials. It's a great way to protect yourself from yourself. So when you get angry, when you have lust, less likely to, there's less of opportunity to act out on it, so it is much easier to be patient with. So you want something, well, if you know you're not going to get it, it's much easier to be mindful of. It's much easier to let it go. So in essence, it's protecting you, or it's a guard from yourself. So like training wheels on a bike, being in the forest makes it easier, especially for new meditators, but it's never going to be comfortable. You're never going to be happy, and you're never going to become free unless you can do the work. The forest won't do the work for you. So it says, yatta na ramati jano, where there is no one delighting. It's a play on words. The word ramati is the same root as ramaniya. Ramaniya is a forest that is delightful. So it's delightful when no one's delighting. So the difference is delighting in sensuality and delighting in freedom. And delighting is probably a bad word, but being happy might be the best. It's pleasant. Pleasant might be a good word. It's pleasant where no one seeks pleasure might be the best translation here. Those who are free from passion are pleased. Might be a good one. But the point being, and the key to this verse is this idea of what can truly please or what can truly make you happy. That's the key here. And it's the key to solving this monk's problem, because his mind, assumedly, is inclining to find pleasure with this courtesan and this prostitute. It's inclining towards the pleasure of a body that is attractive. Attractive probably because, we understand because of the mind's inclination or the mind's recognition of it as an object of pleasure. So we find pleasurable stimulation from either the same gender or the opposite gender, depending on our sexual preference. But we find it just in vision because of lifetime after lifetime, or scientists would say because of our biology, which is programmed to recognize the object as an object of pleasure, a place that is to be enjoyed. So it leads to physical pleasure, it leads to sounds, pleasant sounds, sounds of love and of enjoyment and laughter and so on, all of these pleasant sounds that we so enjoy, pleasant sights, pleasant sounds, pleasant smells. And so as a result, as soon as you see that someone and you say, that's a woman, the sign of the woman for a man inflames the mind. So this is the where his mind was inclined towards. But he realized something, it seems. Not only was he caught up in it, but he realized that it was actually disturbing him. He said, what's going on? What's the meaning of this? And the Buddha straightens out the meaning by saying that actually, or points out that, hey, look what's going on with you. You know, look where this is leading. And it's another useful thing about the forest is that you get to a different state of calm, a different state of peace. So you have pleasure in a sense that is, you could say, wholesome. It's the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of a calm state. Now, I think you could still argue that it would lead to attachment because you can get attached to calm and peaceful states. But there are aspects of it that are wholesome, where the mind is calm and undisturbed, where the mind is fixed and focused. So actually considered to be wholesome, useful. And that's in contrast with trying to find pleasure in lust, in sensuality, because all the chemicals that are involved, all the hormones that are involved, are actually quite disturbing, and they inflame the mind, and they lead to jealousy and irritation. They lead to frustration. They lead eventually to a lot of anger states, unpleasant states. And so he was seeing, in a sense, the unpleasantness of it. It's really the key to this problem of sensuality, this problem of desire. It's the fact, the simple fact, that it's essential for us to learn that these things can't satisfy us, that they don't satisfy us, that they don't make us happy. You can take them, and it's the crux of the problem, really. It's like the answer to this question: why am I not happy? I'm indulging, I'm enjoying, I'm engaging, I have everything anyone could want. Why am I not happy? There's some people I don't think ever come to that, even. They don't ever realize that they're not happy. I've had this argument with people before where they say, well, we get this question a lot, actually. What's wrong with sensual pleasures if it makes you happy? Well, if it really made you happy, there'd be nothing wrong with it. The problem is that it doesn't. And it's funny that often we don't even realize that. Those of us who do are the ones inclined towards spirituality. And we would say that's a better thing, to be displeased by these things. You know? Because it also answers the question as to why we, or answers a more mundane question of how to deal with loss, how to deal with depression, how to deal with really the results of the intense attachment to craving that we have. People who feel low self-esteem because they can't get a romantic partner, you know, who feel like they're ugly, like they're unattractive, because of an intense attachment to just the idea of having sensual or romantic relations. You know? People who get sick or who get overweight because of their attachment to food. People who become depressed when things don't go their way, or even get depressed when things do. You know? People who become addicts, addicted to drugs, addicted to all sorts of things, addicted to entertainment, and just never see it, you know, never get a sense that something's wrong. No, but eventually have to deal with it. You know, so it's an answer to the question of the eventual loss when someone passes away, someone you love dies. It's excruciating loss. And we're so blind, really, in general, that it's confusing to us. No, it's not even confusing to us. It's as though that's a normal part of life. It's become normal to mourn when you lose something, as though it was normal to cling, and as though this is the best we can expect. So we get so caught up in our attachment attachments, so lost in our attachments, that we don't even think to free ourselves from our attachments. Instead, we want something that frees us from the suffering. And the problem is that one leads to the other. You know, when you lose someone you love, well, the real problem was that when you say you love them, you're actually saying you're attached to them. Because love isn't something that makes you suffer. Love is the intention to help others. It's the friendliness that we have. It's the desire for their welfare. You know, there's nothing to do with loss. Loss and suffering caused by loss is because of possessiveness. The idea that it was ours, it was mine. So it has to do with ego and it has to do with attachment. But that's a very far removed state. If you get to that point, which most of us do, it means we're already very much lost in the attachment. What we're talking about in this verse is the fight to not have the attachment in the first place, and the observation that it's so much more primal or primary when you first want something, you know, when you first like and attach to something. Most of us don't see this. Most of us are lost, have to get it later on when we lose something that we love, or when something goes wrong, when we can't get what we want. But the truth is that compared with this monk was seeing, and the reason he was seeing it was because he was meditating, is that compared to the peace of not wanting, wanting is something that inflames the mind. So one who seeks out kama, seeks out sensuality, will never be pleased, will never be happy. Natte ramisanti. Not those who are kama gavesina. Not those who seek out kama, seek out sensuality. They will not be at peace, not in the forest. Well, they won't be at peace anywhere. But the key is that you see it when you have something better, when you have something better to compare it to. If you don't have something better to compare it to, you often think this is as good as it gets, this is the best I can expect. There's this unsatisfying, fleeting moments of pleasure that punctuate our lives of toil and strife, where we have to work long hours, or we have to work meaningless, you know, we have to work in the world, we have to do things, spend our time just for these fleeting moments of pleasure. And so the key here is to see that there is something better, and to see that it's not as good as it gets. It's not the best. It's not true pleasure. It's not true happiness. And that true happiness is beyond that. It's only for those who give it up. This is the claim, and this is the core of this verse, the core of the Buddha's teaching, really, is that happiness is to be gotten through letting go. It's a claim that is backed by meditation, but it's the argument that we give as to why people should practice meditation. You know, are you satisfied with your life? No. Yeah. There is a way to go beyond this. If you can see how unsatisfying these things are, there is a path, there is a practice that gets you past them, gets you beyond them. It's very simple. It's not religious, or it's not about believing in magical powers like the Buddha could read people's minds or project an image of himself across space. It's not about that. It's about seeing the limitation of sensuality and the ultimate unsatisfactory nature of sensual pleasures, which are, rather than satisfying, they're addictive. And they lead to greater and greater states of want and need, until eventually the want and the need comes crashing down, can't be fulfilled, and leads to suffering. And in fact, in and of itself, is a disturbance. So this is what you really see in meditation. And so you see it at a very primal level, that even any kind of touching, the Buddha compared it to feces. So if you wouldn't even want to touch it. It's not, you can say, oh, it's only a little bit of feces, so that's okay. The smallest bit of feces is not worth touching. In the same way, even just the mere seeing of something, or the mere reacting to something that you see, rather, seeing this beautiful woman and then reacting to her, the reaction in and of itself, even before we decide whether he can get it or not get it, not having it, this is what leads us to want to get, is because not having it is suffering. Here his body is shaking in what we would call anticipation, but it's actually in withdrawal, you know, because he doesn't have it yet. The body is saying, get that, get that, get that. Yeah. And that's what leads to suffering. That's what is suffering, really, the not having. And so then you would chase after and get it, and then you'd suffer. I mean, you'd have to disrobe from being a monk. He'd have to get involved with many different things. But most importantly, he'd chase after it, get it, get the pleasure, and then suffer when he didn't have it again, wanting it. So this relates directly to our meditation. This is, here we have a story of a meditator who had to deal with this. So the story goes that he was able to listen, to hear what the Buddha was saying, and he was able to get what the Buddha was saying, and he was able to meditate. You know, as I've talked about meditating on the aspects of desire, the aspects of attachment. So there is the desire, that's a part of it, but there's much more involved. There's the physical sensations, this heat in the body or the tension in the body or whatever physical aspects there are. Then there's the pleasure, which is fleeting, but it's there. When you want something, there's often a pleasure associated with it. Oh, good, I'm going to get that. A sort of excitement will be there. Then there's the image itself that you see. You see this beautiful woman, beautiful man, beautiful thing, beautiful food, whatever it is. That's another part of it. And they work in a sequence. So you'll see the food, gives you pleasure, you want it. You chase, you give rise to an intention, wanting, chasing, getting, and then the cycle continues. So if you cut it off at any place, you catch all of these, break it into its parts, and catch what is really happening in that moment, and then that's all it is. Because the enjoyment is not any one of those things. The cycle itself is not any one of those things. So when you focus only on one of them, you've broken the illusion. You've broken the delusion. You've pierced this misconception of attractiveness. Now, there's nothing attractive about any one of the things. Now, you see something, it's just light. There's nothing attractive there. You recognize it. You want it. Each one of those things is just an individual state. That's what we do in meditation. So we remind ourselves, this is seeing, seeing, this is feeling, feeling, this is wanting, wanting, thinking, thinking, and so on, liking, liking. And if you do that, if you go back and forth between each and one of these things, you can overcome any addiction. You really can. Again, it's just about doing the work. It's not about living in the forest. Obviously, that doesn't work all the time. Even if there's not women coming up to seduce you, yeah, which does happen, but even if there's not, no matter what, there's only a person who can vitaraga, who can free themselves from passion, give up the passions in the mind. Only they will be happy. Actually, this verse doesn't say it, but it doesn't matter in the forest or anywhere. It's not about being in the forest. Although there is something, the verse is also saying that the forest is actually harder to be in. And there's no way anyone who is stuck on sensuality could be happy in the forest, because there's nothing very sensual in the forest. There's no bright lights or pretty colors or beautiful, attractive human beings or food or this or that. It's actually quite hard living in the forest, as we talked about in the last verse. But it's delightful for those who are free from sensuality. Why? Because it's peaceful. Because you don't have people coming to bother you. Because you are able to keep your mind at ease, at peace. Anyway, that's the Dhammapada for tonight. So quite a useful message for all of us. Thank you all for tuning in. Wish you all good practice. Be well. I need headphones now. How do I do this?
Unless it's somehow cleared up between before and now. I don't actually hear myself now. Okay, so maybe you don't need headphones?
Hmm. Okay.
How do I hear it? I don't hear that echo again.
All right, we can go with that.
This has probably been asked before, but does anyone have any tips to prevent a numb leg during sitting meditation, or should I just note it and get used to it?
Yeah, just get used. It's not even about getting used to it. It should get better. Certainly just sit with it and don't be bothered by it. Note if you're bothered by it, note that, liking or disliking. But it should get better over time. It's not, as your body gets used to the practice and your mind loosens up. But, you know, it happens sometimes to the point where your leg completely goes numb. And it's not dangerous. It's not something you should be worried about. Except when you go to stand up, be very careful. Because apparently you can break your leg. That's what I hear. You'll try to put weight on it and you'll fall over, that's quite common, but apparently you can also break your leg. I mean, it makes sense. Apparently some people have broken their legs.
Bhante, is it correct to say that it's very likely to have one or more of these powers when you're so focused and able to be mindful? Because even a non-meditator has intuition and can somewhat predict what's going to happen based on common sense and past experiences. But if one's mind is very focused and strong, one's intuition would be stronger, and so on, maybe. Even so, I don't think we should want this kind of gain from meditating. I think it would be too confusing.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. I don't think about these powers all that much, so I don't mind them, and I think it'd be interesting to explore them to an extent, but, you know, do I have time for them? No. I don't think we should really worry too much about them. But I do think too much skepticism, or this immediate negative response that people sometimes get, how ridiculous kind of thing. It's a shame that people get that way, because there's a lot more to the world than we think.
Venerable Sir, I would like to add Spanish subtitles to your series of videos on how to meditate. I could make text files with transcripts. Would that work?
That would work. If you send them to me, I think you can maybe just upload them. I think you can actually just add subtitles to my videos. I don't know. It's been a while, but someone tried to do that before.
So So he would have to send them back to you, though, so you could put them on your channel, right?
No, I thought you could do it yourself.
And put them on your channel?
There's something about submitting subtitles to other people's videos. If I think I have to just allow it. I can't remember.
It's a great idea, though.
I know at the least I can do it. I have done it before. Yeah. Let me see. Sure, no, if you have any Spanish subtitles that you want me to add, I can at least add them myself. Just don't give me thousands of them, but if you have like 10 videos that you think are really useful and you want Spanish subtitles on them, that'd be awesome.
Well, Fernando said he could do them himself if you liked for your How to Meditate videos.
The question is whether he can put them up himself. May be able to. Subtitles. I don't know.
That's good. Anthony said tonight we sound balanced audio wise. Thank goodness, because lots of audio problems lately. Is there possibility of suffering if we live and enjoy the seeing, wanting, planning, and so on, while being mindful of impermanence and non-attachment?
Sorry, I'm just reading subtitles here. It's got an automatic English translation. It's got speech recognition. First number 98, which reads as follows. The youngest brother, sorry, but I put their heads, three sisters and three brothers, and they all became fungs.
That's the printout of what you supposedly said.
Yeah.
The Dhammapada.
The brothers and became because of sisters became beacon. Beacon is bikunis. Except for Rewata was too young, and he was approaching his 7th birthday, and so there was every expectation that he was going to follow in his older siblings' footsteps. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
The parents weren't so keen on this, so put his parents were Brahmins, and they actually were quite upset. Anyway, not quite.
It's like when you use the speech recognition to do a text message, and you use unusual words, and it usually comes out little bit interesting interpretation. So the question was,
yeah,
is
sorry.
There possibility of suffering if we live and enjoy the seeing, wanting, planning, and so on, while being mindful of impermanence and non-attachment?
You can live, but you can't enjoy it, because enjoying is not being mindful. And you're not mindful of well, maybe that's true. Maybe you are mindful of impermanence. But you're just mindful of the object. The point is to be mindful of the object. When you're mindful of the object, you'll see the impermanence of it, and you'll have no reason to enjoy it. It's not enjoyable, is the point. It's not pleasant. It's an illusion. That's the point.
Are you feeling better, Bhante?
Yeah, you know what I think it was? I had a coffee. I had a coffee, and I was thinking, you know, this idea of coffee being good for you, because a lot of monks have coffee. It's a big thing in the forest tradition in Thailand, I think. They all have coffee in the evening because they've got this idea that somehow it's a medicine that you can keep forever, and so have it, and then you can keep sugar to put in your coffee for 7 days. And so they have sugar and non-dairy creamer they keep for 7 days, because you can keep oil for 7 days. And then there's the idea that, well, it's a kind of a sickness. Anyway, I don't know. Sometimes it gets a little bit over the top. But, you know, there was kind of the idea, well, you know, maybe there's something to that, especially when I'm studying. Coffee could be good. And honestly, I think it is good. I think coffee is useful for study and that kind of thing, for mental exercise. I think it's why people have coffee every day, twice a day, you know? But the curious thing is, if you don't keep having it, and you have to have it multiple times during the day, it seems, you crash. And that's what had happened. And it seemed to upset my sleeping pattern as well. It's really... Yeah. Anyway, enough of that.
Yeah, there are a lot of studies about caffeine being good for studying, but may I recommend green tea? It's a lot gentler, and then if you skip it, you don't crash quite as much. But it does have caffeine, a much smaller amount, about, I think, 25% of what coffee has, something like that.
It's much interesting. Gentler. I mean, I'm skeptical in general of the whole stimulant kind of thing, right? But I can understand how if you're working a job or something, if you really need to perform, we have high standards of performance. Actually, in school now they have like Red Bull, these Red Bull drinks. I guess they're here. Actually, Red Bull is just high caffeine. I think in Asia, Red Bull has crazy stuff in it. Thai Red Bull is really, it has tons
of sugar too.
Right, but there's
Red Bull has tons of sugar plus caffeine.
But there's more to it. In Thai, apparently Thai Red Bull is illegal, or you know, you can't find it here. Oh. Yeah, and it's not just Red Bull, it's all these that they have, I don't know, just insane amounts of stuff. I think they have steroids in them or something, I don't know. But yeah, but here they have these caffeine drinks with huge amounts of caffeine and sugar.
I heard about that company that was putting caffeine in peanut butter. And they've been putting it in water. There's a water product that has caffeine too for people that don't actually like coffee.
I've seen
but
that.
Still feel they need caffeine. So it's kind of crazy.
Well, I can understand it. But, you know, unless you're prepared to take it as a stimulant, like kind of a medicine, you know, certainly for meditators, I think we're right to say no. You know, it's counterproductive for meditation, I would say. It makes you dependent on it and you're less likely to cultivate real energy, real effort. Doesn't give you the opportunity to work for yourself. I mean, it just feels much more natural to not have it. There's really a difference. Anyway, enough of that.
What are the 37 wings?
I don't know. Never heard of something with 37 wings. Most I've heard of is 4 or 6. Don't dragonflies have 4 or maybe 8 wings? I'm going to guess that you're talking about the 37 factors of enlightenment. That's the only 37 that we have, and it happens to be 37. The 37 bodhipakya dhamma, which are the, not factors, but the dhammas which have a part in enlightenment. So they play a part in the attainment of enlightenment. These are the 4 satipatthana, the 4 great efforts, the 4 roads to success, the 5 faculties, the 5 powers, 22, the 7 factors of enlightenment, bhojangas, and then the 8-fold noble path. That's 37.
Yeah, I just looked it up real quick, and it does come up wings to awakening. So apparently, that word wings is used somewhere.
That's a tanis. That's Tanisaro Bhikkhu.
And he uses the word wings.
No, it's his phrase wings to awakening.
Oh, okay.
Which. It's just a stylistic thing, because he's really, you know, he's really a good monk, and he's got good teachings, but I can't believe he said wings to awakening, because wings aren't to something. Wings aren't, he's very awkward in his phrasing. It makes it hard to read his translations. Wings to awakening, it's grammatically or stylistically, it's awkward.
I recently read a book about Elder Lattis, who was a Russian Orthodox spiritual guide. He talked about during his old age, he lived his past again by recalling childhood memories. Would older Buddhist monks just focus on the present and never return to these types of thoughts again?
Well, it's a question of what's the what's proper practice and what does Buddhism consider to be the practice that leads to enlightenment. Dwelling in the past doesn't do that. You know, yeah, okay, great, you can do that. So, what did he get out of it? It's kind of, most of us would think, well, that's kind of romantic, kind of poetic, you know, this old guy. It's interesting you should bring this up. It's, you know, somehow the universe works. It's a proof that the universe works in mysterious ways, because there's no reason you should have brought this up today. You know, how many times have we talked about a Russian Orthodox elder? Have we ever? I don't think anyone's ever posted that.
Never.
I'm going to say never. This morning, two people approached me. I went to McMaster and I had lunch at the cafeteria there. And this woman came up to me and she said, Hamdru. So turns out she's Sri Lankan. I knew right away that's a Sri Lankan word. So, and she was dark skinned. And she said, oh, my son met you, and I guess he's in our Buddhism group. And so she just said hello, and it was nice to meet me. And that was that. I suggested that she come. She apparently lives quite close by here, so I suggested she come by sometime. Not sure if she will. But she works in the cafeteria, which was quite a surprise. But then I went to sit down, and this older, well, still middle-aged Eastern European woman came up to me. And she's just smiling, and she said, I really like you. Something like that. I'm just so happy to see you. I'm so happy you're here. And I said, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. She said, can I give you a hug? And, you know, I have to think quick, because normally I would be, no, you can't give me a hug. But I just kind of sat there, and she came and very lightly put her hand, you know, I think she sensed that I wasn't really into it, and I certainly wasn't going to hug her back. But she just, you know, came around me and touched me with like a feather light touch. And that was that. I think she realized that, as I said, I think she realized, oh, maybe he is a monk. And she said, I'm not Buddhist. Or she said, I know you're not, what did she say? He said, I'm Orthodox, but she said I love Buddhism, I love everyone, I like Buddhism, I like everyone, something like that. I said, well, yes, me too. I said, I'm just so happy that you're here, and thank you, and that was that. But it's not just the Orthodox thing that gets me. It's kind of her, you know. It's kind of nice, and it was a nice conversation. And so the idea of hugging people is I think a part of that. And so it kind of plays into this idea of what people think of spirituality. Everybody wants a hug. I've had other people ask me, can I hug you? Did I talk about that? There was this, one of my classmates actually was having a difficult time and had some, I don't know how it went. I'd like to actually find out, you know, ask her how it went. But at the end, I was just kind of giving her encouragement and talking a little bit about meditation, but only because she asked, and just, you know, hoping that it all works out for the best. And she said, thank you. And she said, can I give you a hug? And I said, no, I'm sorry. Because, Or no, she said, do you give hugs? That's what it was. And I said, no, actually, I don't. And she said, are you joking? I said, no, actually, I'm a Buddhist monk. But, you know, point being, so this is sort of meant to answer your question. Now, this is how a lot of people look at these things and why they think, you know, reminiscing over the past is somehow a value. You know, it could be value to reflect on what you've done right and wrong to get you in the right mind state, but it's not really Buddhist practice. You know, asking about what older Buddhist monks do, what you should really be asking is whether enlightened Buddhist monks do something, because just because you're old doesn't mean you're enlightened. You know, if his goal was just to relive his path, he's not really done anything of value. You want to relive your past, just die and you'll live it all over again and again and again.
I guess that's the difference when you don't, you know, believe that you're going to be reborn. So you have to savor what you've had, because
That's right.
that's it.
That is it.
Anthony says on the topic of coffee, he gets strong headaches and nausea from caffeine withdrawal, but it's useful for getting mental work done.
I've heard about
And I
the
do the
headache
same.
thing, but the headache wouldn't bother me. It's more, I can't function in the afternoon if I have a coffee in the morning. It was quite surprising.
Fatigue. It's like if you don't keep getting more, then you get fatigued. It's kind of awful. That's why the green tea, it's so much milder. It's not that sharp crash. Does liking always arise with a pleasant feeling?
No, it arises either with a pleasant or a neutral feeling. Somanasa sahagatang or upeka sahagatang. We actually memorized this when we learned Abhidhamma. There's 8 types of greed-based mind, lobha mula citta. Somanasa sahagatang dittigata sampayutang asankarikang ekang. That's the first mind. Somanasa sahagatang goes together with somanasa, which is a pleasant mental feeling. Ditigata sampayutang. Ditigata sampayutang. Accompanied by or associated with wrong view. The state of having gone to views or clinging to views. So wrong view is what it means. Asankarikang means unprompted. Unprompted means it comes instinctually, you know, it's not, there's not some reason for it or some external compulsion, like no one's pushing you to do it, or so you're not forcing it to happen, it just comes spontaneously. And then somanasa sahagatang ditigata sampayutang satsangkarikang. So the difference is this is prompted, this means some external influence has prompted you to do it, prompted it. Sort of the desire to give rise to desire or something like that. And then you have somanasa sahagatang ditigata vipayutang, not associated with views. 2 of those, asankarikang and sasankarikang. And then you have 4 others that are upeka sahagatang. So you have upeka sahagatang ditigata sampayutang asankarikang sasankarikang. And then you have upeka sahagatang ditti gata vipayutang asankarikang sasankarikang. Altogether 8. That's
it. Sounded like such a simple question. Such a complicated answer. Is that from Abhidhamma?
That's the first thing you memorize in besides the introduction verses. But yeah, those are the first 8 minds that you learn in Abhidhamma. In the Abhidhammata Sangha.
And then if the question was supposed to be read the other way, does liking always arise with pleasant feeling? Maybe he actually meant, can you have a pleasant feeling without having liking arise?
Pleasant feelings, no. Pleasant feelings can arise with wholesome minds. They can also arise with neutral, with neither wholesome nor unwholesome minds. So vipaka. It would be... think? Yeah, I'm not sure about that one. No, I think maybe not. I think somanasa has to either be wholesome or unwholesome. No, I'm not sure about that. They can't be the result of unwholesomeness, but they can be the result of wholesomeness. So the result of a wholesome mind can be pleasant. And that's not that the resultant one, I don't think it's wholesome. It's just the resultant. So it's the result of good karma is pleasant.
How was Wasa last night?
It was okay. It was short, but sweet. They took a bus over, and then someone gave me a ride back. On Saturday, we have Katina at Wat Kumarakrom. So I have to go there for that. I'll be having lunch there. They want me to come Friday evening, which is less appealing to me. I'm actually maybe going to call May and see if her husband, can drive me. Because I think he comes to McMaster on Saturday.